Chapter 9 Winter Court. We didn't have to worry much about raiders for the next few days, because a nasty wet snowstorm buried the valleys under 6 inches of snow. That was just barely respectable to the rugged Bovali, who were used to the capricious snow gods of the Mindans, Disa and Usa, dumping more than that on the Mindan vales sometimes before the harvest even came in. 6 inches barely got their feet cold. Here in the northern Yuaris, there was the Frost Princess Enyalinda, a corruption of some imperial goddess of yore. The snow she brought was considered a blessing. Big snow, big thaw, lots of water in the streams come spring, and a goodly harvest come fall. Blessing or not, 6 inches of snow effectively shut down most of our construction projects and forced people to stay indoors, those who were fortunate enough to have an indoors. We still had a couple of hundred people in makeshift camps on the commons. Thanks to our magical lumber operation, we had a fair amount of firewood to go around, but the Bovali hadn't brought their winter gear with them through the Mullapar. Sir Kay knew exactly what to do, and Lady Arnott's advice about a good castellan came back to me often. The morning after the snow, he had men and horses stomping their way through the snow between castle and village, and from there to Gurisham and beyond. By noon, every family in the vale had been visited by one of my men, to see if they were in need of food, firewood, or clothing. A few were in need, and Sir Kay had wagons dispatched without my order. I was impressed. But while being a magnanimous and generous lord is fun, the stores would not last forever, we quickly realized. Between Yule and the new arrivals, not to mention the few hundred peasants of Brestall Vale we were now responsible for, we were going through our stocks very quickly. We had gone through an impressive volume of food since we'd been here. We still had some livestock, but we had culled every beast we could spare without eating into our spring flocks and herds. We still had some roots in storage and some feed corn for the animals, but our flour and preserves were dwindling rapidly. We'd need to arrange for more as soon as the snow cleared. In the meantime, we stuck close to the fire and kept pleasantly drunk during the day, and I even managed to teach the rudiments of playing rushes to Alia, hard to do without a proper set. But I had to do something to distract her. She was only a month or so away from delivery, and she simply could not get comfortable, anywhere, in any position. Our bed became festooned with pillows as she tried to elevate various limbs, or her back, or her neck, or head. Every night was a constant quest for the perfect arrangement, none of which lasted very long before they became uncomfortable. Nothing seemed to work, and she was becoming less and less gracious with every passing moment. I tried to put a good face on it, but every attempt I made to make her comfortable not only failed, but seemed to frustrate her further. The only time she stopped groaning and complaining was when she was eating. Fortunately, that was frequent, allowing me to tend to the business of the realm in my spare moments. But my wife's growing appetite was also a factor in the decline in the stores. I would not have the mother of my child starving, so I ensured she always got a noble-sized portion of whatever stew we were having that day. Thankfully, she was being helped by a group of Bovali women, including Alia's sister, who found our castle a better wintering spot than her husband's rickety hold, who had appointed themselves her nurses and maids and sympathizers. They had all been through pregnancies and had plenty of experience with labor and delivery, and they insisted on sharing it with my wife. One, a matronly old biddy called Mother Vika, had brought 9 children into the world and raised 5 of them to adulthood. She alone had lifetimes of experience to pass on to Alia, and she never hesitated to relate an instructional tale or two with every other breath. The others chimed in with their own horror stories, acting as a depressing chorus for Mother Vika. All of this sage advice had the effect of informing Alia of every horrific and painful thing that could possibly go wrong in the birthing chamber, which did nothing to improve her mood. In fact, she started spending an hour or so every day in our bed, sobbing and weeping. At first I tried to comfort her, until Sagal pulled me aside. "Just give her room, lad," he assured me in the great hall the second day of the storm. "The goddess are fit to gift women with all they need to prepare themselves for birth. But it isn't all flowers and rainbows. She gives every woman a trial with every pregnancy, and they just have to get through it. Are you sure? I asked skeptically. Alia had just suggested, strongly, that I take a walk after I tried and failed to adjust the temperature in the bedchamber to her liking several times. It was too damp, she insisted, and I couldn't deny that. But every time I removed the humidity from the air by magic, it seemed to creep back into the tower a few moments later. Or so she said. Then she brought my competency as a mage into question, and that's when I'd retreated to the Great Hall and ran into my brother-in-law. I've seen it happen over and again, he nodded as he poured himself a cup of hot tea from the huge kettle on the fire. If they need to cry, let them cry. If they need to eat, let them eat. If they need tenderness, then give it to them. The goddess gives each mother a trial with each babe, and that shapes the child's character. Or so the priestesses say. This is the one time of your life you just have to shut up and ride it out gracefully, if you value your peace. She doesn't really mean all of that, you know. I know. I think, I said hesitantly. Trust me, he said, slapping me on the shoulder. When she gets like that, just find somewhere else to be. So I spent a lot of time up in my lab, which didn't have much in the way of equipment or furniture yet. It was empty and almost useless, but it was quiet, and not even Alia would disturb me there without great cause. It might have been a cowardly move in the face of a mere pregnant woman, but I will accept that judgment gladly, rather than argue for a confrontation. I love my wife dearly, and my love for her grows every day. But some days it grows a little slower than others. As my apprentices trudged through the snow back and forth to the guard tower, I put whoever was on duty to work rebuilding and organizing the place. I made them practice their craft on the place. I'd run lessons with them at the castle on their day off. Basic stuff. But with Irianite, even basic stuff could be powerful. The other one improved the dike tower. I used each of them according to their talents. When Rondal was at the castle, I had him organize my notes and books, what few I'd been able to purchase, as well as assemble lists of basic components we'd need. Some he could gather around the valley, but others would have to be sent for or purchased. Things like yellow and red knot coral, thaumaturgic glass, weirwood, that sort of thing. Tyndall I put to work building some basic furniture. The boy had a knack for lumbering, we'd discovered, and he had an affinity for wood. I watched with pride as he used some basic binding spells to whip up a couple of trestle tables that had been trees 3 days before. One eventually developed a wobble as the imperfectly kilned wood warped, but otherwise they were quite serviceable. Rondal, on the other hand, had an affinity with stone I did not hesitate to exploit. He felt compelled to match Tyndall's carpentry by recrafting the stone in my lab, knitting the blocks together and smoothing the interior walls to a glass-like finish. He also shaped the narrow windows into rather artful arches and attacked a number of additional stones in strategic places, creating shelves and hooks. Further, in a rare display of artistry from my normally reserved apprentice, he collected stones and knit them together to create an impressive-looking fireplace, bearing a striking resemblance to a dragon's head, down to the fanciful fangs made from splintered flagstones. Tyndall, not wanting to be outdone, turned a trimmed crown of oak branches into a cunning rack for weapons, wands, staves and such. And it wasn't just my lab that benefited. Both used their time away from the tower to curry favour with Lady Alia too. Tyndall presented her with a clever hanging cradle on a wooden spring to help bounce a little tyke to sleep. But I have to give Rondal the most credit for winning my wife's affections. He turned a spare corner of our bedroom, and yes, a round tower can have corners, spare and otherwise, into a deep basin, crafted of broad sheets of slate and magically vitrified clay. After he sealed it tight and smoothed it down, it was larger than a coffin. He'd built my pregnant wife a bathtub. I got the idea from reading Cullet, he explained to me, when he demonstrated it for the first time. When Empress Olifera of the Valley People bore the twin future Arch-Magi, Tesnaris and Tarsus, she prevailed on Archmage Andrus II to build a giant bathing pavilion outside her bower, so that she could suspend herself in the water and relax the great strain on her back. I thought Lady Alia might benefit from such a device. Let's find out, I shrugged. Like everyone else in the castle, I didn't really expect a proper bath until after the equinox, when the water outside was warm enough for a quick one. But there wasn't any reason that Alia had to wait. I had a couple of servants fill the basin with snow, and used spells to warm it until the melted water began to steam. I inspected it carefully for leaks. None, not even around the wooden stopper in the drain. He had wisely positioned it to exit through the exterior wall and into the courtyard. Alia was skeptical when she saw it, and spent a long time on the edge of it just trailing her hand through the water. I finally convinced her to hang her feet in the water, and after that, she quite immodestly threw her clothes off and plunged in. Oh, dear Ishi's beneficent grace, Rondal, after I'm done bearing Min's brat, for this pleasure I'd consider bearing one of yours, she exclaimed, causing the poor boy to stutter unbearably. That led to my highly embarrassed apprentice switching up with Tyndall and spending the next 2 days at the tower. Alia didn't care. The tub was the first hint of comfort she'd enjoyed since she came to Sevendor. After that, she'd spend an hour resting in the water a couple of times a day, surrounded by her matrons-in-waiting, while I was safely elsewhere. Sir Tyndall abandoned the effort to curry favour with her after that, but that did not end their competitive nature. I learned that both boys had spent their time at the guard tower just as busy attempting to show each other up. There, out of my sight, they had rivaled each other with less restraint. First, Rondal had reinforced and strengthened the stone facing of the tower's foundation and remaining walls to a sturdy if unattractive condition. In some cases, he had to raise fallen stonework into position before sealing it. In others, he had to replace the stone with nearby rock. Thankfully, we had an abundance from excavating the dike. It only took him a week to get the lower two stories of Hyre's Tower into defensible, if not livable, condition. Then Tyndall had turned a nearby stand of pine trees into a tight-fitting flooring and a spiral staircase for the tower. Rondal countered by grafting slate merlons to the edge of the roof, which Tyndall rendered even more usable by constructing a rough third story, open to the elements but roofed with tightly woven and tightly spellbound boughs on a stable wooden frame. Rondal riposted with a three-story chimney with a small fireplace on each floor. Tyndall volleyed back with a trestle table and three chairs, and further shaped the wood to look like hideous faces. Rondal, during his two-day self-imposed exile, began the foundations for a secondary building attached to the tower, which eventually became the guardhouse proper. They also took to advertising when they were on duty after that first week. Once Tyndall had capped the tower with his pavilion, the lads took to casting a bright mage light at the peak. Tyndall's was a bright, fiery red, while Rondal's was a deep blue. Either one could be seen across the vale, all the way to the castle, and after they had done that for a week, I began floating a similarly bright mage light above my tower, in bright Irionite green. In case you haven't noted, most magi have egos. Using mage lights thus, so casually, had an unintended effect, Sir Kay informed me 3 weeks after Yule. The Bovali and even the suspicious native Sevendori saw the beacons as both marks of security and badges of pride. Sir Kay claimed that the common folk felt safe and protected by their mage lords when they saw the lights, so I encouraged the practice. Since food stocks were beginning to wane, and tensions were beginning to build between the Bovali and the native Sevendori, I needed everyone to feel as secure as possible. And it's not just the stores that are declining, Mage Lord, Sir Kay informed me quietly when the subject came up at breakfast one morning. Our treasury is much depleted. How depleted? I asked, worried at the answer. There are, perhaps, 1,000 ounces of gold, 4,000 ounces of silver, he said, after ensuring no one else was listening. He would know. The Castellan was the keeper of the Lord's Vault, which in this case was located in Sir Kay's private chambers. I had been considering building a more secure treasury, but from what he'd told me, I would have to worry less and less about robbery. It occurs to me that it will cost at least 6,000 ounces of silver to feed the people of the Two Vales through the winter, Mage Lord. No less. Perhaps more. And my emeralds? I asked, my heart sinking. You have but 2, save for the one your lady bears. He admitted, together, uncut, we could fetch 1,000 ounces of gold. Perhaps, in a large city. I was getting the message. I could get my fief through the winter, he was saying, but I'd be broke if I did. What about revenues coming in? I asked. Rents and such. Don't I get those? I've reworked the accounts since Brestall was included and we made such a dramatic change in administration among the estates. Our revenues from all of them, at present level, will bring us between 200 to 500 ounces of silver, of which 1/3 will go towards paying the garrison for the season, 1/3 to maintaining the castle's household, and 1/3 to pay for essential services. Essential services? I asked dumbly. Yes, Mage Lord, Kay said patiently. The men who tend the roads and fences for the fief, the men who repair the roads and bridges, the men who keep the underbrush cleared from around the castle. In truth, my lord, we've hired 3 times as many such labourers as Sir Arendtal had, and yet we need 3 as many to do a proper job. If Mage Lord wishes to see the fief prosper, he added. Oh, and one more thing, Mage Lord. What? I asked, dazed. The expenditures I mentioned, those were all after the month's tribute to the duchy. Thankfully, that bill will not be due in full until midsummer. We're really spending that much on services? I asked. Yes, we are, he said, dropping the formality, and we need to. You can't properly defend a land without keeping the roads passable, the bridges crossable, and the defences in good repair. You can't. And that takes money, and a fief's only certain revenues are fees and rents and taxes. But the taxes are... they aren't enough to cover our expenses, are they? I observed. Exactly, Mage Lord. This means we have only a few means of recourse. First, we can raise the rents and fees and taxes. That's hardly going to be popular, I said, my throat dry. The rent-raising landlord was a fixture in the lore of the common folk, and one rarely portrayed in a good light. Indeed, tales that began with them often ended in peasants' revolts. But not unusual, he countered. Don't forget, there are a lot more people here now than there were last year. I think we can expect a jump in our revenues once we get everyone settled. By this time next year, we could have rents and taxes in excess of 800 or 900 silver pieces a month. Of course, to sustain that rate, we will have to increase our expenditures accordingly. In the long run, we stand to make a small profit, with careful management. That's in the long run. You said that raising rents was the first thing we could do. What's the second? You could collect ransoms and extort money from your fellow lords, he suggested. Baron Distine of Gilmora made a fortune by engaging his peers in duels and wars, and ransoming them back. That has some appeal, I agreed after consideration, but we're not at war at the moment. There are tournaments and fairs, Mage Lord, he offered. I've never used a lance in my life. I might be able to win a tournament, I agreed after consideration, if I cheated and used magic. A lot. Even then the outcome would be in doubt, chuckled my castellan. There is a high art to the magic of balancing rider, horse, lance, and shield, to each do their part. To persuade a warhorse to charge into another while you hold a lance as steady as a feather is a rare skill, Mage Lord. To do it in war is one thing. If you miss, you merely allow an enemy to live. But to do it squarely, over and over again in front of a crowd of hundreds, it is beyond skill. It is an art beyond the ability of sorcery to mimic. I think that's arguable, I challenged. He didn't know what magic was capable of. But that's not what I meant, he continued, unwilling to be baited. While there are plenty of knights willing to ply their lances on the field for glory and gold, the real money is for the lord who throws such an event. Not only does he collect an entry fee from every contestant, and a rent from every merchant who wants a booth, but a fee for entry to every event. But don't most of the tournaments put up large prizes? The larger the prize, the greater the repute of those who vie for it. He agreed, and the larger in stature the contestants, the larger the crowds. The larger the crowds, the larger the take. The travellers will be eating in your inns, which we don't have at the moment, and buying food from your market, which doesn't have any food at the moment, and making your people prosperous, who are fairly poor right now. The prizes are an investment. If you have enough seed money, you can often turn a very handsome profit. But tournaments and fairs take months or years to plan and prepare for, and we have long to go before we are prepared for that sort of event. I didn't want to dampen the man's enthusiasm or creativity, but dreaming of a tournament when we needed money now, and there was 6 inches of snow on the ground, seemed fanciful. Indeed, he sighed, then perhaps the mage lord will consider the other traditional means of raising revenue for the nobility. Run your docket.
My docket?
I asked, confused. Every lord is responsible for matters of high and low justice in his legal domain, he explained, and criminal cases do, alas, accumulate over time. A lord who carries favour with the gods by applying justice and order to his lands often finds doing so carries a healthier remuneration in court fines. We have criminal cases? I asked, surprised. To my knowledge, outside of a few fights on the commons, things had been relatively peaceful. Several, mage lord. Most have already paid a token bail to avoid the dungeons, but there are 11 cases active at present. 4 are matters from Erenthal's tenure, but still serious enough matters to need the judgment of a lord.
Great. I have to hear criminal cases too and decide punishments, I repeated dully. No one tells me these things.
Did you think the gods or the law brothers were the only ones responsible? You are obliged to render your judgment and wisdom on serious matters of concern for your domain, corrected Sir Kay. That is, to use the power of your position to render justice.
I don't think I'm going to like that part of the job.
Many lords don't, he agreed. They often appoint a seneschal or magistrate to handle them in his stead. But then there are matters of civil law, in which one subject brings suit against another, or asks for you to use your influence to compel payment from someone outside of the realm. And I get to charge a fee for that, I nodded. That seemed a little more reasonable. That assumes I have any influence outside the realm.
We're working on that, Mage Lord, Sir Kay assured me.
The next day, while the clear weather still held, we informed all parties listed in the docket that we would be hearing court in the Great Hall the following day. I got my first direct taste of dispensing justice, thankfully of the low variety. We set up the largest table in front of the fireplace, behind which I and Sir Kay were seated. Rondal had castle duty that day, thankfully, so he acted as scribe and treasurer. Yeoman Sagal acted as my sergeant-at-arms, bailiff and herald, backed up by a couple of husky lads from the garrison. It was odd, sitting in judgment of other people like that. My only qualification was my position and title, a position that granted the responsibility, even obligation, to exercise my authority without much in the way of guidance or training. Sir Kay was no help. He told me to use my noble judgment. Luckily, my first few cases were fairly simple. We began with the oldest crimes, the 4 that remained from the previous management. 2 of them were offences against the dignity of Sir Erenthal, 2 men who had gotten drunk and mouthed off in public about Erenthal's character. I fined them 1 day's labour at the dyke in service of the fief, and had Sir Kay return their bond prices from the big chest on the table. The 3rd case was more serious. A landless peasant named Togan, from a destitute family in Genley, had been caught stealing from the castle when he had been there on an errand. Erenthal had prescribed the loss of a finger for the crime, but hadn't gotten around to it. When I asked him what he had stolen, it turned out to be a copper figurine of Harris, god of luck, thieves and travellers. He claimed that Erenthal's thugs had taken it from him in lieu of rent, when he had paid nearly all of his rent due and was behind only a little. The figurine was from his father, Togan claimed, a relic of a pilgrimage taken to some temple I'd never heard of. Under the circumstances, I felt that a little mercy was in order. Sir Kay had discovered the figurine in question in a box taken from Erenthal's quarters as evidence, and long forgotten there. I returned it to Togan, rescinded the sentence of maiming, and fined him a silver penny instead. He gratefully thanked me and promptly paid his fine,
He had been working in the lumber yards, and had been making a little coin, he said, and a silver for a finger was a bargain. Apparently the patron of thieves, Harris, had been with him after all. The last old case was an assault. Goodman Dronier of Goodisham, a gaunt-looking farmer with a pronounced limp, approached, accused of beating Goodman Joppo, a neighbour, after discovering him between the thighs of his wife, one Goody Ferrer. Sagal called all the parties involved to the bench, and I appraised each one. "So, let me understand this properly," I said, scratching my beard. "Dronier was at market in Sevendore, selling eggs."
"And onions, my lord,"
Dronier interrupted, earning a harsh look from Sir Kay for interrupting. "Eggs and onions. When he sold all his produce early, he went home and discovered his wife Farah. That's you?" I asked of an unfortunate, dumpy-looking farm wife who stood cowering next to Dronier. "You're the seductress?" I asked, surprised.
"She's got right nice hams, my lord,"
Joppo pointed out, gesturing at the hams in question.
"You leave your bloody hams out of it," screamed Dronier,
grabbing his wife's arm protectively. Joppo laughed, and then tried to recover his faculties.
"The proper form of address is mage, lord, or sire Minolan, churl,"
reminded Sir Kay sternly. I let him. That was the whole point of having a dour castellan.
"So you found them involved, and you grabbed a planting tool and proceeded to beat Joppo?"
"Ah, mage lord,"
Dronier said solemnly, "until me neighbours pulled me off. So it seems like you admit your guilt."
"Aye, mage lord,"
he said sorrowfully.
"Yet you don't have a petition on the docket against Joppo for that."
It don't matter, mage lord,"
he said, his eyes downcast, "and it wouldn't do no good.
'Twas the third time I caught him."
"Third? And you didn't beat him the first two times?" I asked incredulously. There was a long pause.
"He were faster than me the first two times. I've been running, though, practicing.
Caught the bastard this time,"
he added, a little triumphantly. "Thus the gods reward healthy exercise," I quipped. "Fine of 2 silver pennies, deducted from your 4-penny bail." Dronier grinned.
"If I let you keep the other 2, mage lord, can I beat the bastard again?" he asked.
Joppo quit smiling when I didn't immediately say no.
"That's an interesting question," I said thoughtfully. "If this is the third time this has happened, then it will happen a 4th, unless something is done. Now that the criminal aspect of this is satisfied, let's address the civil. Goodwife, if that term is entirely appropriate here, Goodwife Farah, do you not love your husband, Dronier?"
The chubby little farm wife looked up at me, her eyes wide with indignant shock at the question.
"Aye, mage lord, with all my heart."
"Then why do you persist in bedding Joppo?" I asked, curious. "Is he taking you without your consent? Because that would be rape, and that would involve a hanging," I said darkly. Joppo wasn't smiling at all now. Indeed, he looked terrified. Goody Ferrer looked almost as afraid.
"No, mage lord, not at all. It's just, he has a mighty root, mage lord, a mighty root, and I can usually say no, but every now and then I just can't,"
she said guiltily, blushing. Joppo looked instantly relieved that he had avoided hanging, but properly embarrassed by having his manhood discussed in open court. "And, Joppo, why do you persist in—" I searched for a metaphor they would understand. "Ploughing a field not yours to plough."
"Well, mage lord," he said, grinning sheepishly, "I'm a man of the world, you know. I get around. The ladies have always liked me company. Man of the world," he repeated.
"Well, I suppose if Joppo's mighty root is the root of this problem, then the simplest solution would be to shorten it," I suggested casually. I wasn't serious. A lord does have that right in a criminal case, but I wasn't given to careless mutilation. I wasn't above threatening careless mutilation, on the other hand.
"No, mage lord," Joppo screamed, looking even more afraid of being shortened than stretched by a noose. "I'd take holy orders as a river brother or a land brother instead, and ne'er ply my root again," he pleaded.
"I'll volunteer to do the shortening," Dronia said, as the crowd roared with laughter.
"Calm yourself, Goodman Dronia," I said, holding up my hand. "I think we can find a less permanent solution to this problem if we try. Are you willing, Joppo?" The wide-faced peasant was visibly relieved, his initial triumph at winning his criminal case long gone as he nodded anxiously.
"Whatever the Mage Lord wishes," he begged desperately, "just spare me, Root."
That brought another roar of laughter. I waited for it to die before I continued. "First, a fine of 3 silver pennies for each carnal offence against Goodman Dronia," I said sternly. "Seducing another man's wife might not be a criminal matter, but it disturbs the peace of the village."
"Thank you, Mage Lord,"
Joppo said fervently. "Oh, I'm not done," I said. "You have the fortune to be the subject of a Mage Lord, Joppo, which means I have more means at my disposal than a common lord," I pointed out. "One suggestion would be to magically sever the nerves connected to your root," I offered. "That would leave you impotent without the need to hack off anything."
"Nay, Mage Lord,"
Joppo squirmed.
"If I can avoid it,"
he added. "Another solution would be to remove you from the village. Has any other man here found Joppo in his bed? Or suspected it?" From the murmurs, there had been a few. "Then it seems you're a moral hazard to the entire community. Tell me, Joppo, are you wed?"
"Nay, Mage Lord,"
he said, a new kind of fear creeping into his eyes. "Why not? You seem more than equipped to handle a wife. Several, even," I added, gaining more laughter at Joppo's expense.
Because I don't want to pledge my plough to just one furrow when they all need a ploughing, if you take my meaning, Mage Lord,"
he admitted guiltily. "The ladies like me."
"I like them,"
he added guiltily. "I dare say you've had your chance to try a fair number," I pointed out. "Far more than most men your age. You're 20? 22? Then it is past time you had a wife. You work the common fields of Gurisham." He nodded. "No more," I decided. "You are released from service in Gurisham, Goodman Joppo. You are to report to Yeoman Rollo in the new village we're building in northern Bresthall, near to the gate. There you will begin service as a drover. We'll be sending out wagons to Sendaria on Bontal within the week. You should be driving one," I sentenced. "Perhaps if your route has more room to roam." Joppo looked uncomfortable.
Sendaria, Mage Lord?"
he asked nervously. "What? You haven't been to Sendaria, Goodman Joppo?"
"Nay, Mage Lord.
I went with my dad once, or the past to Sashtalia, but that's as far as I've been." I inspected him closely. "I'm sure a man of the world like you will find the experience broadening, and I expect that Goodman Dronia would appreciate the opportunity to lay with his own wife without fear of being cuckolded. Of course, if you would prefer the alternative of magical impotence..."
"I always wanted to try my hand at handling a team, Mage Lord,"
Joppo assured me quickly, nodding emphatically. "Excellent. Pay your fine to Sir Kay and off you go. Next case!" The rest of the criminal cases were more recent, and involved everything from petty theft to fighting in the commons to disturbing the peace. Most of the accused were Bovali emigres. I appeased justice with a few hefty fines for the worst cases, and dismissal in those I felt warranted it. None of them were particularly interesting. At the end of the criminal session, the fines for the day had ended up being 28 silver pennies and 15 copper ones. Not bad for a morning's work, sitting on my ass, not lifting a wand. But the day wasn't done yet. There were the civil cases to get through, and those were more time-consuming. The court process was simple, I learned. The plaintiff came forward and told his story, then the defendant told his. I asked a bunch of questions, and then I decided the matter. My judgment was final and absolute, unless the parties both wanted to appeal to my liege, Duke Rard. From what I understood, the ducal docket for such small-holding cases had a waiting list going back decades. For good or ill, I was the last word, practically speaking, in each case. The first two cases involved livestock, the third a vegetable garden, but the fourth and fifth cases on the docket were matters of inheritance, one in Gerlor's hold and one in Sevendor village proper.
Each took near an hour to get through, and both were difficult cases. One involved a breach of promise combined with an early death, and the other concerned the disposition of two choice pieces of property that had suddenly become very valuable with the sudden population explosion in the valley. At the end of the session, both got settled, and if the decisions didn't please everyone involved, they at least cleared the docket. The fief received over 100 silver pennies in each case as our fee for deciding the matter. Considering the value of the property in question, that seemed a small price for the victors. Lastly, there was the matter of high justice, namely dealing with prisoners of war. The four prisoners in the dungeon, the garrison of Brestold Tower we captured when we reconquered the province, were brought before me, after being fed and clothed, and I gave them a choice to either take up arms for Sevendor, or to pay a ransom of 2 ounces of gold each within a year, and never darken Sevendor's veils again. Two of the men proved to be native Sevendori, and were happy to take an oath and enlist in the garrison. Ironically, they would be guarding the same tower they had lost to me. I required 3 months of free service from them in lieu of ransom, and they were grateful for the chance. The other two were mercenaries, who had been expecting execution, technically illegal, but widely practiced with sellswords who had no liege to advocate for them. They were pleased to pledge gold for their lives, and swore on a statue of Duin, the destroyer, patron of soldiers, that they would make good on their pledge. "Do you think they will?" I asked Sir Kay, as Yeoman Sagal closed the court session in his booming voice. "It depends on their honour and their fortunes," he admitted. "I'd say it's about a 50-50 chance, and we don't have to feed them any more," Sir Kay pointed out. "That's not too bad," I nodded. "We've raised a little more coin than I'd thought, but still not enough, Mage Lord," he said quietly. "At this rate, even with this influx, we will be broke by the equinox if no other income is forthcoming." "I could always raise taxes," I pointed out. "You don't want to raise taxes," he reminded me. "I don't want to raise taxes," I agreed. "Is it too early in the season for conquest?" "It would be difficult to manage at this time of year," Sir Kay agreed. "Well," I sighed, "there is one other way I could raise some quick cash." "And that would be what, exactly, my lord?" he asked a little warily. No doubt he thought I was considering proposing cutting back on personnel costs, limiting our expenditures through austerity. "But I'm a baker's son. I don't like austerity. It's bad for business." "I can go to work," I said grudgingly. "I'm not just a spellmonger. I'm a high mage. A mage lord, too. But that doesn't mean I can't still work. If I do a couple of quick jobs, I can probably raise a little cash to get us through the spring." "And who might wish to hire a high mage?" he asked pointedly. "Save perhaps for Gimbal of Westflaria, to deal with his new problem neighbor." "That's a good question," I nodded. "Let's find out. Have that foot wizard who wandered in here a few weeks ago report to the castle tomorrow morning. I'm feeling a need for gossip."